We're going to get right to it. If you would be turning your Bibles to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Hebrews chapter 11. I like to talk about faith because I think this is one of those topics that is greatly misunderstood. And we have to spend some time trying to get the world around us to understand a little bit more about what we mean when we talk about faith. In fact, there are some common ideas that are out there that I think we run into with this. For example, you might run into someone who says that faith is believing something in spite of evidence. Or that faith and reason are somehow at odds with each other. And I think we find that these are common concepts out there that people have. So if you say to somebody, "I have faith," what they hear is, "You're superstitious." Or what they hear is, "Well, that means that you just believe a bunch of stuff that's not proven, and, you know, I have science and you have faith," and so they try to put these things at odds with one another, that faith is superstition and science is knowledge. And so in today's modern world, if you're concerned about truth, if you're concerned about knowledge, then you should go with science and you shouldn't even have faith. And I've heard people say, "I don't have faith in anything." Well, that's a misunderstanding of what faith is, and it's particularly a misunderstanding of what biblical faith is. Really is. And it's our task, I think, in some ways, to kind of debunk the false concepts and establish a biblical working definition of faith. When we talk about faith, what do we mean? There's a couple of things we're going to talk about this week that kind of hit the same pattern. And I think it's important because often what we find is when we're having a discussion with somebody, when you use a word and they use a word, it might be the same word, but you might mean different things by it. You might not have the same view in mind when you hear it. So that's one of the problems with the word faith. When you hear the word faith, what do you hear? When an unbeliever hears the word faith, what does that person hear? Same thing with the word God. We're going to talk about God a little bit later today and look at the same type of problem, that when you talk about God and when an unbeliever talks about God, you might be completely missing each other because you have completely different concepts in mind. And so definition becomes really important for us to understand what it is that we're talking about. We're going to have to establish a working definition of faith. And we want, of course, to encourage true faith in such a way that our lives are going to reflect our trust. And I would like you to think about the word faith as a trust, the idea that you're trusting God. And that goes further than simply a mere mental assent to something. It's important to mentally agree or mentally assent to something, but it's more than just that. So I want to come back then and think about some passages right up front here. And think about the passage there in Hebrews 11 and verse 6. You're familiar with it. "Without faith, it is impossible to please Him, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists and He rewards those who seek Him." That's in the ESV. And so the idea that, of course, there's no way to please God. We have no possibility of pleasing God unless we have faith. But again, what are we talking about when we're talking about faith? And our idea of establishing a biblical working concept here is important. But then I want to think about this in John the 20th chapter for just a moment. In John chapter 20, Jesus has made His resurrection appearance, or one of them, to His disciples. And you might recall that on that first occasion there, who was missing? Who wasn't there? Well, Thomas was missing. And of course, this is where we get this concept of a doubting Thomas. Because Thomas says to the other disciples, what? "I'm not going to believe unless I first see or touch." He's got this concept that his faith has to be grounded in what he can see and touch. That's not unlike the way people view faith today. So when Jesus appears the second time and He says to Thomas, "Go ahead and touch. Here it is. Look, you can see, you can feel it." And Thomas says in verse 28, "My Lord and my God." And so there is a proper response on Thomas's part that Jesus offers this to him. But what's important that for our discussion is what happens next. Because Jesus makes the point in verse 29 that you believe because you've seen me. Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe. And so that idea there that there's a blessing really that comes from the concept that you can believe even though you haven't seen. But that's not to be equated with there being no evidence for our faith. Because notice what he says next. And John then tells us, and this is a well-known passage to us, but it's on the heels of that point. Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe. And many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, not written in this book. These are written for what purpose? That you may believe he is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. So John tells us that the signs were done and recorded so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. And then, of course, the consequence of that, having life in his name. So we haven't seen Jesus. Peter makes the point in 1 Peter chapter 1 that we haven't seen him. We rejoice even though we haven't seen him. We haven't laid our eyes on Jesus ourselves, but the testimony is there and we believe even though we haven't seen that the signs were done, the signs were recorded for that very purpose. And Jesus says you can believe even though you haven't seen. But then I want us to note what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3. Now, Peter is writing here to those who were undergoing some kind of persecution or were about to, and he's letting them know that you need to be prepared to suffer that persecution. Arm yourselves in verse 1 of chapter 4. Arm yourselves with the same purpose, because he who had suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So you need to be ready to suffer. But back earlier in chapter 3 then, he asks that question, who is there to harm you? In verse 13, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed, and do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled. I like to think about that concept because it's easy for us to get intimidated by the world. The world wants to bully. The world wants to threaten. And it's easy to get intimidated by that. And Peter is saying, don't worry about that. Don't be troubled by that. Don't be intimidated by what the world is going to throw at you. But look at verse 15. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Set him apart as Lord in your hearts. Always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, or gentleness and respect. And so the idea here of being prepared to give a defense, that word for defense is the word from which we get apology. Now I realize that when we think about an apology today, what do we think about? I'm sorry. Well, he's not saying here, be sorry for your faith. That's not his point. Paul uses the same word in Philippians chapter 1, 16 and 17 when he says, I'm set for the defense of the gospel. The idea here is a verbal defense, that you're willing to stand up and give a reason why you believe what you do. Now, when we act like we ought to, and I'm thinking if you drop back to 1 Peter 2 and verse 12, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. People are going to watch the way that you live, and if they see that you're serious about what you believe, questions are going to come. Why do you do that? Why do you act that way? Why do you believe what you believe? And Peter's point in chapter 3 is, if you've set Jesus in your heart as your Lord, and you're ready to give an answer, then you're going to be in a position that when somebody asks you about why you have this hope, you can say, this is why I believe. This is why I do what I do. And we've got to think that way. We've got to be in a position where we're willing and ready to do just that. So if we're going to define what we mean by faith, what can we say about that? I want to turn back to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now we've already read verse 6, which tells us, of course, that without faith it's impossible to please him. But if you drop back to verse 1, he says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And some translations there say the evidence of things not seen. Now his point is not that, there's all this evidence for faith. Now, don't get me wrong, there is evidence for faith. But the point he's making in Hebrews 11 and verse 1 is faith stands under your hope. The reason we have hope is because we have faith. Now, what exactly is that faith? Faith is a conviction, he says. Faith is a conviction of things that have not been seen. And we've already said, you can believe even though you haven't seen. Jesus made that point. Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet have believed. So what we're talking about here really is this, that faith stands under our hope and demonstrates our conviction in the reality of what we cannot see. Faith is the demonstration, the evidence. Faith itself is the evidence that you accept the reality of things you cannot see. It is a trust in that reality. And that tells us that our perspective is very different from the way the world is. You know, I think about passages like in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where Paul there, talking in a context of himself being persecuted, makes the point there that, you know, our outward man is perishing, the inward man is being renewed day by day. And then in verse 17, he says, our momentary light affliction is this passing affliction. And what we have is a greater glory to come. Why could Paul say that? How could Paul say that? Well, he could say it based upon the perspective that he offers. If you notice in verse 18 of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, while we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. Because the things that are seen are temporary, and the things that are not seen are eternal. So the things that are not seen are eternal. We're focused on what we cannot actually visibly see. That doesn't mean they're not real. They're very real. But we're demonstrating in our faith, we are demonstrating that we have a conviction, a trust in the reality of those things that we cannot see and that we know are eternal. That's a perspective that we have. That's a perspective that Christians ought to have. That's the basis of our worldview. And so are we demonstrating that trust in the reality here of what we can't see? Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the nature of the faith that we have. In fact, if we think about the reasonable nature of our faith, now I realize that for some in the world, they're going to see that as contradictory. Wait, faith is not reasonable. But understand that God has never said to you to check your brains at the door when you become a Christian. God gave you a mind. He gave us minds to think, to reason, to look at information, to process that information, to draw conclusions. That is all part of the reasoning process, and faith is a part of that process. You are choosing to believe because you believe that the best explanation for the evidence that you do have is best explained by even what you cannot see. So what is involved, what's required if we're going to have a reasonable kind of faith? Now, when I say that, I understand it's possible to have an unreasonable faith. There are some things that people believe that you might just say, there's no particular reason for that. That's an unreasonable thing that this person accepts and does. Okay, but that's not the way it is with our biblical faith. In fact, one of the things that I believe we need to have is some level of understanding of what we're talking about. And I reference here Acts the 17th chapter, that when Paul goes into the city of Athens in verses 22 through 31, I'm not going to read all of that, but I do want you to think about what he does here. He goes into the city of Athens, and what does he recognize? He sees that there's all these, the evidence of idols, altars and statues and temples that are all around in Athens. And you could walk through the streets and they'd be lining the streets. And then he sees this one that says to an unknown God, the unknown God. Paul seizes upon that particular one and he says, that's the God I want to talk to you about. And by doing that, he shows that all of these other gods do not approximate the God in whom we believe. He says, I want to talk to you about the God you don't know. And may I suggest to you that that might be one of the proper starting points for us today. Because people have all these various concepts and views of who God is. And most of the time that's going to be wrong in the world. We need to talk to them about the God they don't know and try to have a better understanding. But my point is, when Paul begins to talk about God, there is a demonstration of some level of understanding there. If we're going to talk to people about being a Christian, you've got to understand what it means to be a Christian. If you're going to talk to somebody about who God is, you've got to have some level of understanding of what you're talking about. Just like we recognize anybody who teaches or preaches ought to have some level of understanding of what they're talking about, so it is for any Christian who goes out into the world and talks to somebody. If you're going to talk about moral values, you got to have some knowledge of that. Whatever it is, there has to be some level of understanding of what we're talking about. God doesn't want us talking about Him if we'd have no clue what we're talking about. Think about what James says in James 3, let not many become teachers. They incur a stricter judgment. Be careful is the point that he's really making there, because if we're just going out there and saying things and we have no idea what we're talking about, we're going to do more damage than help. So be careful about it. There needs to be some level of understanding of that. But secondly, there needs to be a readiness to act upon it. How can we say we really have faith? Now remember, if faith is a demonstration of the conviction that we have and trust that we have in what we cannot see, then the demonstration itself has to be something that we're doing. It's not just a mental thing. It's an action. I think about this in Mark, the second chapter, when the paralyzed man was let down in the roof, you know, before Jesus by the four men and brought down. And Jesus, the first thing it says there in verse 5 of Mark 2 is, he saw their faith. You realize faith is something you can see? Because it's not just in the mind. Yes, it starts in the mind. There has to be a belief in the mind. It's kind of like it says in Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10, if you believe in the heart that God has raised Him from the dead and you confess Him as Lord, there has to be a confession, an outward thing that you're doing to demonstrate the trust that you have inside. And that's what James 2, verses 14, really through the rest of the chapter talks about. If you say to somebody, you know, I have faith, well, show me that you have faith. Don't just say to somebody, be warmed and filled. Do something for them. Show that you have faith. And that's the point. There has to be a readiness to act. If we're going to just tell people you got to believe something and there's nothing else going on, that's a shallow, hollow kind of view of faith. But thirdly, there needs to be a reason for that acceptance. And we've already referenced 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, to be ready to give a defense or a reason for the hope that is in you. Why do you believe what you believe? Why do you accept what you accept? Why do you act the way that you act here? And there has to be some reason for that. And I love John 6. When Jesus gives the bread of life discourse in John 6, he concludes there by saying some things that were pretty offensive to some people. You've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood if you're going to have life in you. And people misunderstood. The book of John is filled with people misunderstanding Jesus. And here in John 6, they misunderstand him. They don't know what he means by that, but they're offended by it anyway because it sounds pretty bad. And so they turn and walk away. Jesus turns to his disciples and he says, are you going to go away too? And this is one of Peter's brilliant moments. Peter has some brilliant moments. He has some not so brilliant moments. This is one of his brilliant moments. Because he says there in verse 68, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. They had a reason for believing that Jesus was the Holy One of God. They have been witnesses to him. They've been watching. They've been part of his life. They may not fully understand everything that he's teaching, but they know he means it, and they know he can back it up. And they know he is who he said he is. And so there was a reason for that. So the question is, when somebody asks you, why do you believe in that anyway? And it may come in any number of forms. It may be even somewhat of a mocking tone. You know, yeah, about that faith thing. How's that working out for you? Well, you know, I'd like to talk to you about that. Why do you believe in that God thing? And why would you believe in that? Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that unknown God. There has to be some reason there and a willingness on your part to discuss that with somebody. Can you tell somebody else why you believe in God? Why you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Why were you baptized in the name of Jesus? Why do you come here and do this every... Why are you acting this way? Because the world typically doesn't understand that. And we have to have some level of understanding, a willingness to act, and a reason for that. And so you'll notice here that faith involves... I'll just put it in three things here. Faith involves the intellect. That's the use of the mind, of course. When I say that it's not just a mental thing, it's not just a mental assent that you have, don't misunderstand that to mean there's no mental assent. There is. There has to be an intellectual recognition. My mind is agreeing with what I know is the case over here. And so there's an intellectual side of that, but there's also an emotional side of that. You know, it's tough sometimes for us to kind of balance this out, to recognize that on the one hand, our faith has this intellectual component to it. But on the other hand, there's also an emotional component to our faith. God doesn't want us to just be robots. He gave us emotions. We're made in His image, and we have very much the emotions of God, if you will. And it's okay to feel those emotions. The problem is when we let the feelings get in front of the intellect. When we let the feelings take the lead over the facts. That's when it becomes a problem. God doesn't want us to do that. It's possible to be led astray by our emotions. And feelings by themselves are never a good guide. But that doesn't mean that we don't have feelings that need to be properly used and let out. There are emotional components, for example, to our singing or to our prayers. I mean, these are emotional activities as well as anything. But emotions don't take the lead. Emotions follow the facts. That's the way it ought to be. But my point is that faith involves both of these components. But here's the thing. That by itself is not the sum total of what faith involves. Because I want you to think about the fact that in James 2 and verse 19... you believe that God is one, you do well, even the demons believe and shudder. Now, do you realize that in that statement, you have both the intellectual and the emotional components of faith involved? The demons, isn't it interesting that when you're reading the gospel accounts, how often it's the demons who know who Jesus is? In fact, there's interesting contrast there because you have people who are versed in the law, who are supposed to know what's going on. They're supposed to know that Jesus is the one who he's claiming to be, and they're seeing Jesus work miracles, but they're denying him. And here are the demons over here saying, we know that you're the Holy One of God. We know who you are. They believed. and they shuddered. That's an emotional response. So even the demons have the intellect and the emotion. That's not the sum total of what faith is. Have you ever studied with someone or talked with someone who intellectually recognizes the truth? I've had people say that. They're sitting there across the table say, I can see that's what the Bible teaches. I've even seen people have emotional reactions to that. I've seen people cry. I've seen people stand in pews at Invitation Song, crying but holding on to the pew, knowing that they need to respond. They have an intellectual belief. They have an emotional reaction, but that's the end of it, and that's not good enough. There has to be the will engaged. Put it into practice. If we don't engage the will, we're like the demons. We believe, we shudder, but then that's the end of it. And again, James 2 shows all three of these components in place. You engage the will, you act upon it. Faith involves all of these things. Now I'm going to tell you, the world doesn't see faith this way, but the Bible does. And so again, part of our task is to help people understand that when we're talking about faith, this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about superstition. We're not talking about believing weird things in spite of evidence. We're talking about a demonstrated trust in the reality of what we cannot see based upon the evidence that we do have. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later this morning. Now, there are some things that faith does not require, and I think it's important that we at least acknowledge that, you know, when we talk about having a level of understanding, for example, I am not thereby suggesting that we understand everything. Okay? Because I will tell you right now that if that's the standard, if we have to understand everything, none of us should have faith. Who here understands everything about God? I don't. In fact, the Bible tells us that there are things about God that we're not going to understand. I love Ephesians 3 and verse 20 because it tells us that God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything we can ask or think. Now let that sink in for just a moment. God is able to do. Now, just at the bare minimum, God is able to do what you cannot think, okay? But notice the superlatives in there. God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything that you can ask or think. So right there tells us that there are going to be things about the nature of God and the workings of God that we will not understand. We can't even think them. How dare we put God in a box? We don't have the ability to do that. We'll talk more about God tonight. But this is a starting point. There's some aspects of God we won't understand. Romans 11, 33 and 34 tell us that the wisdom and the knowledge of God is unfathomable to us. His understanding is infinite. And so when we talk about God, we're not saying that we understand everything about God, but there are some fundamental things that God has revealed about Himself that we can understand and we're expected to understand. But just because we don't understand something doesn't mean in and of itself that we can't utilize that. In fact, that's not the way we ordinarily work. Now, usually I'll get a hand or two when I ask these questions. But for example, can anybody here completely take a car apart and put it back together? You know every component, every part, you know. Maybe somebody, most of it, okay. But my point is that usually there's somebody, but I don't. I mean, before the cars in the last 10 years, I used to be able to change oil and spark plugs. Now you got to have computers to do that. I don't understand it all, but I'll tell you what, that doesn't stop me from driving it. What about a computer? Everything about a computer. all the components, every part, you know, you can take it apart, build your own, put it back together. Well, again, there are people who do that. I don't. There's a lot about computers I still don't understand, but that doesn't keep me from using them. You see the point? Even in our normal daily operation of things, we exercise trust in things that we don't fully understand and know. That doesn't make it unreasonable. In fact, we would look at that and say, well, it's unreasonable. If somebody said, I don't understand every single component about a vehicle, therefore I'm not going to drive, you're going to say, that's not a very reasonable position to take. We don't understand everything about God. But we can understand enough to know that we can exercise our faith and trust in Him. I don't have to know every why to put my trust in God. And Job is a good example here of the kind of trust that can be offered. And Job, of course, is a fairly complicated book. I mean, you've got people who are giving doctrines about God that they're really messing up on. They say some good things, but then they say some things that just aren't true. And they're rebuked for it. In fact, when God speaks up in Job 38, I love the way he begins his discourse. He says, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? If I could paraphrase that, it would basically be this. You guys have no clue what you're talking about. I wonder sometimes in all of our theological discussions and all the things we get into, if God would say that to us. You guys have no clue. But if you were to ask me something like, why did my aunt or uncle or father and mother, why did they suffer? I don't know. I can tell you in a broad sense why suffering came into this world because of sin. But I don't know the reason for every account of suffering. Or why a particular person suffers this particular thing or that. I don't know. We don't have all the answers to that. But I don't have to know why in order to put my trust in God who does know why. So in that sense, you know, if you're a parent, you know full well that when your children are little, when they're toddlers, you're going to do things that they don't understand, but you do. You're going to teach them things and tell them things that they don't understand. And they might even, you know, they all reach that stage where they start asking, right? Why? Why? And you might say, well, because of this, because of that. And then finally you say the very thing that you always said you wouldn't say. Because I said so. And you know what? You understand that, they don't. It's perfectly reasonable, even though they don't understand it. But my point is, here, how much bigger of a gap is there between us and God than there is between a parent and a child? I don't understand everything. I don't have to understand it. I don't have to understand all the whys and the wherefores to still be able to put my trust in God who does know. And I don't have to physically see. We've already made this point. Blessed are those who haven't seen yet have believed. But you know, we all exercise faith in things that we haven't seen, in things that we don't fully understand. And nobody escapes this. Everybody does it in one way or another. We don't have to physically see it. And I think about it kind of like going into a court of law. You know, when you go into a court of law, As a juror, there's a reason you're on the jury and not on the eyewitness stand. Because if you were an eyewitness, you'd be on the eyewitness stand, you wouldn't be a juror, right? They don't mix the two. So you go into a court of law as a juror and evidence is being placed before you relative to something you have not seen physically. Think about it. You didn't witness the crime that's on trial. And so what you're doing is you're weighing the evidence. You're looking at it and you're trying to put it all together. And the way it works in a court of law is that you're not just asked to explain this one piece of evidence only. You're asked to explain that piece of evidence as it comports with all the other pieces of evidence. In other words, it's a cumulative case that's being made. It's not just one thing or even two things. It's several things put together. And then you ask, what's the best explanation for all of this put together? And that's how you make your decision. And so you're going to have things like documents, maybe. Here are some documents that say that, maybe emails today or whatever it may be. Here are some eyewitnesses who say that they witnessed it, that they were there. And there may only be one, but the more eyewitnesses that are in place, you're going to say, well, that's probably more likely what happened because, you know, you got 10 people here who all say the same thing. And there might be, you know, comprehensive explanations about this as they put all the pieces of the puzzle together. It's like putting a puzzle together. And you're trying to see how everything fits and all of that. So you got comprehensive explanations that are going on. As we say, it's a cumulative case. It's not just one thing, but several things that are put together. And it's what we call inference to the best explanation. That's just what we call it. What's the best explanation? And an inference, by the way, is just a conclusion that you draw. So you've drawn a conclusion about what you think the best explanation for all of this evidence put together is. And that leads you to what you would call having, you know, a decision beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the language that we use in courts of law. Beyond a reasonable doubt. And we consider that to be strong enough and powerful enough in a court of law that we can convict somebody of a crime. Now, does that process ever go wrong? Yeah, it can. But overall, we know it's a pretty good system. And that's what works. And that's what has worked. But you know, when you're looking at things like historical questions and all that, what else are you going to be able to do? So as in historical matters, we weren't there. But we trust the reality of it. Let me ask you this question. You think you know the answer? Who was the first president of the United States? Anybody know the answer to that? Let me ask you something. Were you there? How do you know? How do you know George Washington was... How do you know that? Well, because all the documentation shows that, and this is what the history says about that. And well, yeah, you're right. But that's the way it works in historical matters. When you look at history, you're going to look at the best explanation of all the evidence that you have. That's basically the point. In fact, I like to ask even about our own personal families. Now, I don't want this to sound wrong, but, you know, how do you know your mom is your mom? You say, well, because she told me so. Well, how do you know you weren't switched at birth or some other collusion going on or what? How do you know that? Now, I would say you weren't there. You were there, but you're not going to remember it, okay? Let me ask you this. How many of you have done the scientific or the DNA testing to prove that you know who your parents are? I did. Okay, look, not because I was concerned about that. My mother is really big into genealogy. And so she calls me up one day and she says, Doy, I need you to get a DNA test for me. I'm going to send you a kit. I said, Mom, I don't want to go into the system. She said, well, I need you to do this because I'm trying to prove a line over here is, you know, so I did. And yeah, she's my mom and, you know, the line was proven. But my point is you don't have to do that to trust that your parents got it right. That's the way we operate. That's what we know to be the case. But when it comes to the scriptures, we have a statement like this in Luke chapter 1. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that have been taught. Now, other translations will talk about, you know, certainty of the things that have been accomplished among us, or investigated everything carefully from the beginning. And Luke tells us here that our faith is historical. And we're going to talk in the second hour about the resurrection specifically. So I'll save that. But our faith is historical. And our faith is something that can be investigated. And I really want to stress that point to you. Our faith can be investigated. And that's one of the things that sets us apart from those who might say, well, how do you know that this is true? Well, because I feel it. What's the problem with that? Nobody can investigate your feelings. If you tell me you feel something, all I can say is, okay. I can't change what you feel. I can't test what you feel. But then the question is, how are your feelings truth for me? See the problem? Because what if I feel differently? At that point, we might as well be discussing the flavor of ice cream, right? What's the best flavor? Well, I feel this, I feel chocolate, I feel vanilla. All of that's irrelevant. Your faith is investigated in history. And Luke says you can test it. And so next hour, we'll talk about the resurrection and how that shows us the history of our faith. I appreciate your attention.